Hello and welcome to another episode of Pakistanomy. My name is Uzair Yunus, and today's episode is going to feature not a conversation on Pakistan or what's going on over there. This is a topic that, you know, on the Pakistan side, what I've been meaning to cover in the next few episodes is related to the worsening security situation over there. We have seen attacks on Chinese workers, attack on a naval base, etc. And if you've been listening to this podcast, you kind of know that we have had guests over the last couple of years that have been warning about this potential risk to security in Pakistan. But I figured, you know, we have spent a few weeks now without going back to Palestine and Gaza and what's going on over there. So I figured today's episode, we go back nearly 6 months after Hamas's terror attacks on October 7th to understand the situation, understand what's going on in Western capitals and why and how policy essentially in places like Washington and London seems to be out of sync with growing public opposition to that policy. So joining me today is Jasmine Al-Gamal. Jasmine is a national security expert, political analyst, and former Middle East advisor at the Pentagon. She is also the founder and CEO of Mindwork Strategies, a consulting firm with a mission to help organizations craft empathy-based, culturally different approaches to foreign policy, communications, and workplace mental health. She has served throughout her 22-year career in various public and private organizations covering issues related to security and international affairs. And from 2008 to 13, Jasmine served as a Middle East advisor in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for Middle East Policy. So she's somebody who deeply understands sort of how the sausage is made, as we may say it, about American foreign policy in the Middle East and how and why it never seems to shift despite all sorts of public pressure and opposition. And, you know, I'm guessing many of you have been following the war in Gaza and the death and destruction and the atrocities being committed on a daily basis by Israeli forces. The UN has had a report out on this as well. The ICJ has had hearings and I think yesterday put out an order, cannot enforce it, but still a very substantial order demanding that Israel allow more aid. We have started seeing pictures of children dying due to starvation and what is basically famine setting in Gaza at this point in time, and aid is not getting in. And that's not, is this is not just about aid at the moment. There's a lot more to it that, in my view at least, Western press in particular is getting wrong. And every day there's something or the other that is infuriating in terms of lines of questionings or remarks from the State Department or the White House. So we're going to talk to Jasmine about all of that. First of all, Jasmine, welcome to Pakistanomy and thank you so much for taking out the time today.
Thank you so much for having me, and Ramadan Mubarak to you and to all your listeners. I know we're about halfway through already, so I hope everyone is getting on as well as can be expected.
Yeah, I think it's I'm recording right after Suhoor and it's getting to this phase in Ramadan, which is very common. The last 12 or so days are, you know, oddly speaking, the hardest. So yes, we're at the tail end of this. And you know, it's been a very different type of Ramadan this year, at least for me at a personal level. And I'm sure for you as well. I want to begin this conversation, Jasmine, with sort of the, you know, having you explain your analysis of the overall situation in Palestine and then what Israel is trying to do. We're nearly 6 months in, 6 months of siege, 6 months of bombardment, 6 months of, you know, using collective punishment as a tool of warfare. That's against international humanitarian law. But Israel's goal, I want to start there. From the outset, there have been two stated goals that I've seen. And if I'm wrong, I would love for you to correct me. One is that the complete destruction of Hamas as a force to be reckoned with in Gaza. That's the military goal. But more importantly, and this is part of the South African and now the Irish case in the ICJ, this idea that it's not just about the destruction of Hamas, but it is about the destruction of the Palestinian people in Gaza. We have Bibi Netanyahu's, you know, references to the children of Amalek and using the Torah as, you know, to me and to you, obviously, as well, I would argue, looking at counterterrorism in the Middle East, like very much like what ISIS and Taliban logic to warfare, right? Using the religious sacred text to justify why they want to kill people en masse. How successful do you think Israel has been in its stated goals in the war in Gaza? And am I correct in framing the goals in these two ways, or do you see it a bit differently?
I think that it's a bit strange when we talk about, Israel's stated goals, because on one hand, you're correct in saying that their stated official goal is to dismantle and destroy Hamas and make sure that, as they say it, another October 7th can never happen again. That is their stated official goal, on paper. That's why, how they justify everything that they're doing in Gaza right now. The second goal that you're talking about may be a goal of theirs sort of internally. Even they publicly make statements that seem to indicate that they want a complete erasure of Palestinians from Gaza. However, that is not an official stated goal of theirs. Obviously, whenever they are criticized for what they're doing in Gaza, and especially including during the ICJ hearings, you did hear the official line coming out of Israel saying again and again, no, we're just after Hamas. We don't want to erase Palestinians. In fact, we are taking extra care to make sure that we're minimizing civilian casualties. We're not hampering assistance from coming in. So the second goal that you stated may be something that they internally, hope for. They certainly have said things that indicate that they don't want to deal with Palestinians in Gaza anymore. But just to differentiate between the two, one is an actual stated goal that they use to justify their actions, and another one is something that they are probably wishing and hoping for. And some of their ministers say things here and there that they don't think will be used against them, but it's not their actual stated goal on paper. Now, ironically, you have the stated goal and the non-official goal, right? Ironically, what they are actually accomplishing is the second goal, the one that is not stated officially, the one that relates to the erasure of Palestinian life from Gaza. That is actually what they're accomplishing, even though they're saying that that's not what they want to do. What they want to do is really just get rid of Hamas. When it comes to their official stated goal of getting rid of Hamas, they are every single thing that they have been doing in Gaza for the last 5 months has been going directly against that stated goal. Everything that they've been doing is creating more anger, more trauma, more displacement. Every single thing that they've been doing is helping Hamas, actually, and in the future is going to make Israel, as I've been arguing over and over again for the last 5 months, much less secure than it was before October 7th. So they are failing miserably at that goal. If they think that what they've been doing is actually going to get rid of Hamas, it may get rid of Hamas members, it may get rid of Hamas leadership temporarily, but are they actually getting rid of the idea of resistance against an occupation, which is the idea that Hamas was built on? I would argue that absolutely not. They're doing the exact opposite.
And that's a very interesting point, right? And I want to cut at and sort of follow up on that point that you've made in two ways. One, from my own sort of experience following the war in Afghanistan, right? This was the whole reason why many at that time, over 20 years, argued the high value target strategy isn't going to work. There's an insurgency. Yes, you can blame Pakistan for safe havens, but that's a symptom of the problem, not the problem in and of itself. And lo and behold, within days of America trying to leave Afghanistan, $2 trillion or whatever the amount might be in blood and treasure, collectively, the Taliban are back. And the ideology is stronger than it ever was, one would argue, to the loss and to the devastation of many in the region who do not want Afghanistan to go back to the ways of the Taliban. But that was the failure of that strategy. But
On
in
that note,
yes.
Uzair, I mean, look at Iraq. Look at the Iraq invasion. You know, any of your listeners who are around, 35, 40 years old and upwards will remember the US military, the Department of Defense putting out this deck of playing cards. Do you remember that had all the names and the pictures of all of the top Ba'ath party members, the Saddam and his henchmen, so to speak, and these were the people they were going after. Where are we now in Iraq and what has happened between now and then? So exactly to your point, this idea that you can take out an organization that is built on an idea, that on a concept, by taking out its leadership. Well, there are many more leaders where that came from. If you don't get rid of the actual root cause of the problem and why that organization was created in the first place.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that at least for me sitting in Washington, who has friends and family in the region, in Pakistan in my case, right, and some Afghans that I know, many of whom had to leave after the departure of the American forces from Kabul. It is real sort of emotionally and sort of collectively as with friends and families, traumatizing to see that, right? Because the first recipients of another wave of terrorism and militancy with this idea surviving are our friends and family. And when we see Western capitals fail to understand and acknowledge how counterproductive their strategies are, we criticize out of a place of love, primarily for our own friends and family in the region who suffer day in, day out from these failed choices and policies. So I want to be very clear about where this criticism is coming from, primarily, and we'll get to that later in the podcast about the environment in which you live in and I live in the West and Western capitals. But the point I wanted to get to, as a follow-up of the point you made, is I would argue, and I would love your thoughts on this, that not only is it counterproductive on the ideological side and sort of a new generation of people who have been orphaned and traumatized and hit hard by Israeli atrocities. But when we look at Al-Shifa Hospital, and the claims that, oh, we've cleared North Gaza out and we're now going into the South. And then it turns out a few days later, there, I think this is day 11 of a second siege of the Al-Shifa Hospital. And it turns out, wait a minute, all your claims about, I don't know how many brigades of Hamas have been dismantled and tens of thousands of Hamas fighters have been killed, doesn't really stand up to scrutiny because you're back to Al-Shifa. After dropping 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs time and time again, like, I don't know how many total nuclear weapons have been dropped on Gaza at this point in time, but you're back at the same place where this war started, which was your first operation. How do you see even the operational failures of the Israeli military at this point?
It goes back to, so this actually, before I go into that, I will say that what you're describing, this is something that I was talking about yesterday, actually, with Yalda Hakim on her new show on Sky News, basically talking about how the operations of the IDF in Gaza, they really highlight the fact that we have no credible independent way of verifying the IDF's claims, or even Hamas's claims for that matter. There's no independent mechanism. People that are allowed to go in as is the case in any other conflict, when you have reporters going in, when you have international organizations going in, when you have inspectors going in. For example, when in a military setting, when you go in and you, let's say, bomb a hospital, right? Because you thought that there were, or you claimed that there were Hamas militants hiding there, or there were tunnels under that hospital. And normally what would happen is that you would go in afterwards, and you would do something called a battle damage assessment. So you would have a team going in and you would say, okay, so this was our goal in going in. Did we accomplish that goal? What did we accomplish? What didn't we accomplish? How many civilian casualties were there? You talk to people at hospitals and doctors at hospitals nearby. You sort of try to paint a picture of what's happening. And that is how you come to a credible conclusion. Was this a successful strike or not? None of that, of course, is able to happen in Gaza because the IDF won't allow independent journalists, outside journalists, or other independent organizations to go in. I remember the first time they went into Al-Shifa when there was a huge controversy over whether they should have gone in or not. There was another incident where there was a rocket fired and people were arguing whether it was Israeli rocket. I think it was also a hospital. I don't remember if it was Al-Shifa or maybe Al-Ahli. I don't remember, but it was basically dueling claims of was this an errant Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket, or was it an Israeli rocket? And news outlets, The Guardian, for example, did an extensive open source intelligence. We call it OSINT, which just basically means from the outside, you're looking at satellite images, visual imagery, and you're trying to piece together what
I
happened in
think
an
Al Jazeera had
outside.
a video from a CCTV camera of that.
Exactly, exactly. So that's what outsiders are sort of left with. In the absence of being able to go in and actually examine what's happening, we're having to rely on people doing visual investigations using satellite imagery. But of course, that never gets to the heart of what actually happened. So, this latest incident in Al-Shifa, you have the IDF story, then you have eyewitnesses on the ground. I was just listening to Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, who is now in London, but for the first few weeks of the war was in Gaza, has seen horrific, things from his time there, had to operate on people without anesthesia, including children. And he still gets information from his colleagues, other doctors who are Palestinian, who are in Gaza, and they send him photos. And so you have those stories. But you don't have any independent way of verifying it. And so what happens is what's basically been happening since the beginning of this war is that people will pick the narrative that they want to believe based on their own beliefs and their own ideologies and their own experiences, and they will just discard anything else.
And I think this is a very important point you raised because it came up in a conversation I was having with some journalists in Washington a couple of weeks ago, that it is the IDF that won't allow independent international media in except when they're embedded with the IDF and they
Exactly.
have to comply with their censors,
And they
which,
have to show them their videos beforehand
And
before
this
they.
doesn't even happen in Ukraine. And even the Ukrainians allow journalists to go to the
Yeah.
front lines at great risk to them, knowingly so, but they want to report to the world what exactly is happening. And that leads, to your first point on initial point on the unofficial goal of Israel only strengthens that conversation because if you are taking all the precaution and care, why won't you let ABC and NBC and Sky and CNN journalists to go in and cover the war like they cover any other conflict in the world,
Exactly.
like they've covered Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Ukraine, name your place, they've been there without such levels of control that the Israelis are demanding. I want to move to another question that has come up a lot. And that this, at least for me, I don't know what it's like in where you are, but in Washington, it keeps coming up. Whenever you push back against American stance and American policy right now, and the argument is, well, if Hamas truly cared about Palestinians, they would drop their weapons and surrender and release all hostages, and there would be a ceasefire immediately after that. I don't buy that. I'm not the expert, but what's your view on this argument that keeps being pushed in terms of let Hamas surrender?
Yeah. Well, listen, a couple of points on that. I will say that before October 7th, by and large, I would say the majority of people and governments in the world weren't really thinking about the Palestinian question on a day-to-day basis, right? We didn't really, people didn't realize what Palestinians' lives were like before October 7th. You hear a lot of Israeli officials coming out and saying, well, there was a ceasefire before October 7th, like Hamas had no reason to do what they did. The fact is, there wasn't. Of course, there were no, the Israelis had withdrawn their settlers and withdrawn their presence from Gaza, I believe in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. However, they still controlled everything going in and out of Gaza. They control financial assets, what goes in, what goes out. So
If I may
That's not.
interrupt just for the audience, because we cover economic affairs a lot on this podcast, the Palestinians cannot issue their own currency, even.
Yeah.
Let's remind people of that fact that if you claim that you're not controlling them and their economy, why don't they get the right to have their own currency is a key question I ask from an economic point of view, but please.
In fact, just today I was reading a headline that because of the sanctions against certain settlers that the US has placed, now the Israeli government is threatening to withhold money to the Palestinian Authority. I mean, it's a very controlling kind of relationship. And so you can't really, so that's one thing I just want to put in context, because when people say Hamas had no, they did this out of the blue. It wasn't really out of the blue. It wasn't, people just weren't paying attention to the Palestinian question, including, by the way, Arab countries, including other Muslim countries. It was sort of something in the very, very, very back of people's minds, if at all. Now, that said, so just to put that in context, you know, there has been obviously a 75, 76-year occupation of the Palestinian territories by Israel. That's a fact. That is the context in which Hamas was created as a resistance organization, and so on. However, we also have to say, we have to be able to look at all parties to this conflict and talk about, okay, who is to blame for what is happening right now? And when you have such a horrendous situation on the ground right now, you really can't put the blame. And I want to try to say this in the most fair way possible, because we have to sort of parse this in a bit of a nuanced way, because I'd like to also touch upon, and I think you mentioned this in your questions before when we were chatting about this idea of sort of violent resistance versus nonviolent resistance, and how none of it has been acceptable to the international community when it comes to the Palestinians, neither violent nor nonviolent. So we have to talk about that as well and why that is. But for its part, I would say it is my personal belief that Hamas is not without blame in the current situation. I mean, they may have their reasons for doing what they're doing, but the fact is that there is an element of truth, of course. There are Hamas tunnels under buildings. We know that. That is a fact. We do know that Hamas fighters don't necessarily wear uniforms to identify themselves. So sometimes it's difficult to tell who's a Hamas fighter and who's not. They blend into the population. Yes, we have to be able to say that. We have to be able to say this is a fact. However, does this fact justify the extent and the scale of the Israeli response? The answer, of course, is no. Israel is not the first country or military in the world to fight against a non-state actor in an urban environment, a non-state actor that hides amongst civilians. The US did it for years in the Middle East, in Asia. They fought against non-state actors in urban environments. They did not go in and destroy entire towns and cities and villages and heritage sites and universities and hospitals because they were trying to get to that non-state actor. So I think in order to be able to have this full discussion, we have to be able to look at every actor in the conflict and really honestly talk about what everyone is doing. Now, Hamas leadership has said in the media, they understand that they are sacrificing a lot of Palestinian lives, but they see it as a worthwhile sacrifice for a greater good. Now, you can agree with that or not, but we also have to understand it for what it is. They know what they're doing. This is a strategy. They knew on October 7th that the Israeli response would be massive. They knew that there would be a lot of Palestinian civilians dying. They did it anyway because they believe that this will eventually, in the long term, lead to an end to the occupation.
Yeah, and that's a very, I think, 2 points on that. When I was at grad school, my professor actually wrote the book called The Marine State Ambar, and it was basically a study of the counterinsurgency campaign in Fallujah and everything else at huge cost to the Marines, when they had to clear that region out. And that then informed my own research on the counterinsurgency doctrine, evolved counterinsurgency doctrine of the Pakistani army in the tribal, at that point, the tribal regions of Pakistan, which are now known as FATA. And there's you may be familiar with the author Ivan Toft has written about it, how the weak win wars, and the strategy against industrialized modern armies is to be asymmetric. And when you're asymmetric, the industrialized army has to deploy what academics in the academic literature refer to as a strategy of barbarism, which is what the Syrians have deployed, the Americans deployed, the Pakistanis deployed. And that essentially means forcing people into, in the Pakistani context, IDPs, internally displaced people, in the context of Mosul and Fallujah and Anbar, forcing people out and then going in and fighting street to street, door to door, as well. And that comes at huge reputational costs from the literature that has been studied for centuries now, in case studies. And from that point of view, when I look at Hamas and its strategy, terrorism, in my opinion, can never be tolerated as a strategy by any non-state or state armed group. And they've deployed that. But when I dispassionately, despite my sort of anger and lack of tolerance for terrorism as a strategy, I look at their strategy as an analyst, I sort of conclude, based on the literature I read, that it kind of makes sense. And the way it makes sense is that they have a higher tolerance of pain and destruction and everything else because it leads to erosion of reputation of their adversary and erosion of standing, morals and ethical standing of their adversary in a way that would otherwise not be possible. And the Israelis seem to be playing into their hand in terms of their overall strategy in Gaza. I want to sort of, based on that, ask another question, right? You alluded to this about terrorism and the way it's raised. You have been on television channels, and I've seen a lot of conversations with in the run-up to this podcast that you've been on, but especially in the post-October 7 scenario. When people look like you or look like me or have names that are like you or like me, the question is, do you condemn Hamas? But the question is never asked of the Israelis or the pro-Israeli people, do you condemn Israeli terrorism? The word self-defense, even yesterday, Joe Biden was in New York at a fundraiser and kept using this term, Israel has a right to self-defense, but it's never used in the context of Palestinians and their occupation of their lands. To me, the definition of terrorism is use of violence against civilians by non-state actors to achieve political goals. If I look at that four checklist, Israeli settlers, of which there are over 700,000 on Palestinian lands right now, are terrorists. They occupy land using terrorism, violence against civilians by non-state actors to achieve a political goal, the political goal being greater Israel. Why do you think in the West there is this double standard when it comes to the definition of terrorism and who this label does apply and does not apply to?
It's funny that you asked that question because it's a question that I have evolved on over the last probably 2 decades, I would say. And the conclusion that I arrived at was a conclusion that many of my friends and fellow analysts who are also, either Arab American or Muslim American or just Muslim or Arab, they have been telling me this for years, and I think I sort of came at it from a very idealistic way, let's just say. Just for your listeners, I mean, I am a daughter of immigrants. My family immigrated from Egypt to the US, and I was born in New York, so I grew up with that sort of immigrant mentality of the US is the shining city on the hill, and this is where, this is the country that gave us our opportunities and so on. And of course that narrative is valid, but of course it's not the entire narrative of the West. And that narrative, that sort of battle of narratives or the discrepancy of narratives of the West, not just the US, between the ideals that we're always taught that the West embodies: democracy, freedom of speech, fairness, justice, rule of law. That has really come crashing down over the last 5 months. And of course, some would say that this was only the latest incident of Western hypocrisy showing, because they showed it in Syria, they showed it in Iraq, they showed it with Afghanistan, they showed it with, so
Well,
many
if I
other.
may interrupt, my African American friends told me very early on in this conflict, as I was having this exact conversation, and they were like, "Welcome to the club. We've been here the longest, and now you can learn
Absolutely.
from our experience." And I was like, "Touche, very good point."
Exactly. I was once on CNN years ago, and I was talking about something about what Trump said. And I remember saying, and I was on the panel with a Black American, I think he was a New York Times journalist or something. And I remember saying, but this is not the America I know. And this guy was just like, really? Really? Do you know what happened to my people? I mean, and so of course, and I'm saying this as sort of a way to almost hold myself to account as an individual, because what a lot of people are grappling with now, what a lot of Americans are grappling with now, especially younger Americans, they are looking at what their country is doing. They're looking at what the West is doing and how it's acting in Gaza, and they're really having this moment where they're thinking, wait, this is who we are. This is what we do. And the reason I'm giving this very long introduction to my answer is that for a very long time, and especially because I worked in government, I worked in the US government for 8 years, and I served my country in many ways for even longer than that. And so it was very hard for me to eventually come to the conclusion to be able to say what I'm going to say now, which is basically that there is a problem of racism and dehumanization against Muslims in the world. This is a basic fact. If you look at any country, any conflict, if you look at the refugee crises that have been occurring over the last several years and how different types of refugees are treated, if you look at women wearing hijab in European countries or in Western countries and how they're treated, I mean, there is a problem. And the reason it's so important to say that is because we can't fix it until we talk about it and identify it. And it took me a long time to see it. But of course, that is the answer to your question, is that if you just go back to, let's say, September 11th, just so that we have somewhere to start with, and I remember as a young, teenager turning 20, around that time, being really wondering why I had to condemn the attacks of September 11th when they were targeted at my home city of New York. I was the victim here, along with everyone else in New York City, and yet you were also asking me to condemn it as if I had anything to do with it or represented, those hijackers. And so this idea that we are always asked to apologize, to make excuses for, or to explain what's happening when it's done in the name of our religion, that is an unfortunate fact that we have to live with. People have different ways of dealing with it. I know that, I have some friends who say, just condemn it, get it over with, and then move on to the point that you want to make. And then some other people will say, I shouldn't have to. And so, of course, everyone will have to deal with it the way that they see fit. But this is the position we're in. It's an unfair position. And yet, what am I going to say? The world is not fair. This is the position we're in, and we just have to deal with it the way I'm surprised that in the last 5 months, I have not yet been asked that question on TV. And but I think about it all the time. I think about what would I say if I were asked that question. Everyone has to decide for their own, for their own what works for them. But the reality is that I think this is the last thing I'll say on it. Just so I know you probably want to move to another point, but I suspect that it is because the perpetrators who are perpetrating these crimes or terrorist attacks are doing it in the name of Islam. They are saying, this is Islam. We are Muslims and we are good Muslims and we're doing this because we are Muslims. That's why people tend to say, okay, well, but they're doing it. I mean, ISIS was called the Islamic State. What do you, what, you know, how do you explain that? There's no good answer. We could have a whole podcast episode just on why that is and what we should do about it. But again, I come back to the fact that there is an inherent level of racism and dehumanization against people from the Muslim faith, Muslim countries, Arab countries, brown people, whatever you want to call them, that is rampant in Western societies. And of course, I'm sure you see that as well, but it's just an unfortunate fact that we have to live with.
And it's my vivid memory as an immigrant to America dates back to almost 20 years ago. I was 16 at the time, coming to the US and did not qualify for special security screening, before S's, as they are put in our boarding passes every once in a while. But because I was a tall brown Muslim man, taller than my age at the time, with the middle name Muhammad in it, I was put in the security screening area without any adults around me who were my family for 4 hours. Just questioned about, have you had chemical weapons training? And I was just a teenager who loved to play FIFA and, Counter-Strike video games just like any other teenager. And it was that remark, Jasmine, that set off the immigration officer, because he asked, like, oh, you don't look 16, you're too tall, what do they feed you there? I still remember that question. And as a brash teenager, I just said, same thing they feed teenagers in America who play basketball, a lot of McDonald's and burgers and chicken nuggets. And he did not like my snark. And so there I was for 4 hours. And
That's
it still
crazy.
happens. Every few trips, there will be the four S's on my boarding pass, and when you go into the screening room, it's brown and black people that are being
Absolutely,
screened.
absolutely. And the thing is, and maybe I'll sort of say maybe optimistic or sort of action-oriented, thing about this. Even if you look at the way that Western governments describe, or even the way Israel, for example, will talk about young men in Gaza right now, they use this term that I've always hated because I have 3 brothers, military-aged males. I'm sure you've heard that term
This is what
before.
the Obama administration used to count official militants dead in drone strikes when they were even civilians, because they were military-aged males killed in the attack.
Right. And what, you talking about yourself as a 16-year-old kid, me thinking about my younger brother who would fit that profile of a male between the ages of, 15 and 45 or 60, however they're counting it now, to be called something so dehumanizing. You're no longer a boy or a husband or a brother or a student or a basketball player or a FIFA lover. You are a military-aged male. And the action-oriented thing that I want to say about this, so that it's not a completely depressing conversation, is I think that the reason for that is that there has historically been such a lack of diversity in high-level positions in the West. So even though you have a lot of diverse populations in Western countries, a lot of immigration, you don't see a lot of senior-level officials who come from different backgrounds. It's still a minority. And I think, but it's changing, of course, and the more, I mean, even now in the UK, you have Rishi Sunak, who is the first minority prime minister in the UK. Whether or not you like Rishi Sunak, I'm not talking about whether he's a good prime minister or not. I'm just saying the more diversity there is in positions of power, in journalism, in national security, in all of these fields where decisions are made about the fate of other people, the more diversity there is, the more representation it is, the less and less I believe we will see these types of things. But it is a very, very long and slow road, but I do see progress being made. So
No,
I'll just leave it on a bit of a high note.
I completely agree. In fact, one of my mentors, she was a national security expert in the early post 9/11 years, right? And post Gaza, I was talking to her about how furious I was about how things were being conversed about and everything else. And she was like, "This is still much better than, you don't know what it was like post 9/11 when we were just a handful of people in sort of this town." And I remember telling her, because her advice was like, be patient, keep your head down, work the system. And I was like, no, I think you and your cohort has walked the hard yards over the last 20 years, enough of them so that some of us can, be brave enough and venture out to jog a bit. And maybe we'll jog past you a little bit, and the next generation will be able to run to that destination. But it is a process. I completely agree, and it's a process where even progressive people who are, share the same values and the principles, because this is not just about Muslim Americans or Muslim British people or Arabs or anything like that. There is a broad coalition that brings me to my follow-on question, but that coalition has to be patient and work the national security system, so to speak, to force that change. That is the beauty of democracy still, is that you can work that system if you understand the levers of power and how they work and begin to use them to your advantage. And I see that happen. I've seen that happen in the last 10 years. Forget about 20, 30 years since 9/11 as well.
It's baby steps, you know. I mean, when I started working at the Pentagon, I was in the Middle East office, in the office of the Secretary of Defense, and I was the only Arab American Muslim who also spoke Arabic. Who could, and it's the Middle East office, right? You would
During a
think
war that in the
it was
consequential
when I started, it was 2008, so
eight.
we were not in a war, but still, I mean, now of course it's different. Now there have been many, many, different backgrounds and the diversity and successive leaders at the Pentagon, especially under President Obama. Who cared a lot about diversity, made sure that that changed, but it is a very, very incremental change. And you know what? I mean, if we just look at, for example, the African American community and sort of their struggles in the US, and you went through the civil rights era, and today, still today in 2024, they struggle as a community. We have issues of racism. We have issues of police brutality against Black Americans. I mean, Pro we will I don't I mean I don't know that we will ever get to a perfect world where everything is fair and just and everyone's represented equally, but is progress being made? My husband always likes to remind me of that whenever we have these conversations. He says, but is there progress being made? And of course, we are all part of that progress. We all do our part to be part of that progress.
Speaking of that progress, one area where we're beginning to see this now, early on, this was early November, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine who sort of is in the broader democratic establishment political ecosystem. And I was beginning to warn him, right? I was like, look, from my vantage point, 90 plus percent of my ecosystem of 50 to 100 people voted for Joe Biden. It has flipped. And I'm just telling you, it has flipped, and you are have a as the party have a growing problem on your hands, and you need to reckon with this. They're very dismissive at that time. People will forget about it. Spring will come. We'll talk about the economy. People don't really, they're not single issue voters. And I kept telling them, look, I am seeing this not only from the Muslim and Arab American or immigrant American lens. People who truly care about this at an emotional level, much more than other conflicts. That's just how people are. But I'm seeing this from my younger cohort. And then now the polls are shifting. The latest Gallup poll, you may have seen a vast majority of Democrats oppose the president's policies. The uncommitted campaign in Michigan and Minnesota and Hawaii has forced a reckoning just yesterday. President Biden was at a fundraiser in New York with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, and I think he spent over 15 minutes explaining his policy on Gaza, and there were protests outside and everything. So this is not going away. And it's evident in the UK, even growing so from my friends in Germany. I hear this even in Germany, policy is out of step with public opinion. The question I had for you was, in that environment, this is positive. I see this as a big step change. Organization matters, public pressure matters, advocacy matters, and we're seeing the results. How would you think about consolidating those gains moving forward? Because my fear is that what the American strategy at least seems to be is, let's abandon Bibi. He's a roadblock, not Israeli policy writ large. We will have a new prime minister, and my fear is that new prime minister will get an amazing military aid package from the United States once more, lip service to the two-state solution, and we will go back to the status quo. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's my fear. And so my question is, based on your experience, progress is being made. How do we consolidate this progress to change Western foreign policy for the better in the world with a more moral responsibility?
So that's a really excellent question, and it's a really important question. To your point about the U.S.-Israel relationship, I just had an article just today that came out in the New Statesman that basically explained how no matter what the personal relationship is or the tensions between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu, that doesn't really affect the institutionalized support for Israel by the United States and that really special relationship between the US and Israel. So that will continue. That has not been touched. There was a US, the 2024 spending bill that was just passed in the Senate included the same amount of assistance to Israel as it does every year, $3.8 billion, and so on. Now, to be clear, every country has a right to have special allies and special relationships. I mean, the fact that the US and Israel have a special relationship is not wrong in itself as a principle. Of course, if you want to have that relationship, if that's going to be your ally, sure. Just don't use that relationship as a way to project harm, or don't let that relationship come at the expense of a people like the Palestinians, for example. Right? That's what I always say to people, that policy doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. You don't have to decide between this and that. And Washington, D.C., I mean, I lived there for 12 years and worked there. It is the capital city of zero sum. It's like, are you pro-Iran or pro-Saudi? Are you with India or are you with Pakistan? Are you this or, it's like, God, this is not the
Which is
question.
really weird for a unipolar power and its capital to operate in, because the de by definition, a unipolar power like the United States has so much leverage and so much capacity that it can never be in a zero-sum game because it has something to offer to everybody.
Right. And it's just such a sort of ridiculous framing. It's an unnecessary choice that that people think that they have to make, that if you support X, then by definition it means you have to be against Y. So if we sort of understand that what is happening right now with Israel and Gaza and with the Palestinians is a special moment. There's a lot of momentum around Palestinian statehood. There is a lot of activism around the world, not just from Arabs or Muslims, but from allies, from all different kinds of communities of all ages who are just pro-justice, pro-humanity. What I always say to people when I talk to them and they ask me this question is that I just say, this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. This is a this is a generations long project. The march towards justice is generations long, no matter what the topic is that you're talking about. And we wouldn't be here talking about this if it wasn't for people talking about this before us. And now we're a bit stronger and we're a bit louder, but then the generation the next generation will be even stronger and louder. And so that only happens if people stay the course, and if they do things like organize, get involved, find coalitions and communities that they can be a part of, find like-minded people that they can be a part of. These are things that activists have known for a really long time. You can't move a mountain by yourself. You're going to need help. And so I think one mistake that a lot of people do when they're trying to support a specific cause is that they think that their way is the only way, and that everyone else should be doing it their way or else they're wrong. So, for example, just to make that example a bit more tangible, if you have, let's say, because this episode is about Gaza, let's take the Palestinian issue and Gaza, for example. You have activists who are going out and protesting every Saturday, for example, and boycotting and talking about, economic boycotts, cultural boycotts, all of that stuff. You have academics and analysts who talk about it, who write about it, and so on. You have policymakers who are in government trying however they can from the inside to make a difference. Now, you might have an activist look at the person who's still in government, in the US government, and saying, "Shame on you. How dare you? You should have resigned." This is... No, they are doing their part. If that's where they think they are most helpful, then that is where they need to be. And the reality is, to change any sort of situation in the long term, you need all of these categories. You need the activists to make noise. You need the writers and the analysts and the journalists to talk about it and to spread it and to make it understandable to other people. And you need the people on the inside to take all of that and turn it into policy. So this idea that it has to be one way or the highway, that's very damaging to long-term sustainable progress on these issues, whatever your issue is, whatever the topic is. So I would say, A, stay the course. When this issue stops becoming front news, are you still going to pay attention to it? Are you still going to donate? Are you still going to go to marches? Are you still going to read about it? Are you, that's a question that you have to ask yourself, because if that's not the case, then we're not going to see the progress that we want to see when it comes to justice. Again, I'm talking here about justice. I'm talking about two countries living side by side in the Middle East, in freedom and dignity and security, so that we don't have to have another war every other year. And the only way, of course, that that will become sustainable is if you have a peaceful settlement between the two countries. That is a long-term goal. And what I'm saying is, just so I'm not going on and on, but I just think this is such an important point. People get bored quickly. People see this, the thing on the news, they get excited and then they get tired. Don't get tired if this is something that you care about. And also understand that everyone will have to contribute in their own way, and every one of those ways is necessary.
That is such an important point. In fact, over the last 6 months, friends of mine who are in government, one of the things I've tried to do is whenever we meet, I repeatedly tell them, thank you for your service. You need to hunker down and you need to stay the course because we need you in the system. And let those of us who are outside the system work the system for you from the outside. Don't it's hard. It's emotionally taxing, it's mentally exhausting, it's triggering, it's angering, but don't leave your post. And there are those, as you said, will criticize. And that's why, at a personal level, I found it very important to remind them and thank them for their service because we need them, people allies in the system, as well. And other thing I would add, Jasmine, is that it's also important, as you mentioned, on justice to build that coalition, right? Go to the next Black Lives Matter protest. Build allies in the Black community because they are the ones who suffered at the hands of this injustice the longest. Their strategies can teach you a lot about what needs to happen in the system. Go to progressive and Jewish protests with the Donald Trump rise again. Anti-Semitism is back. Give them a hug. Tell them this is wrong and we condemn it and we support them and we are allies. Go to indigenous communities. who are being affected by, you know, far longer, even longer than Black Americans of
100%.
American policy. Build allies there. This will require a big tent coalition, so to speak, that continues for a long time. And my own framework for this, just, you know, last point on this, as a Indian Pakistani whose family came from Indian Gujarat, migrated partition, I did not know this until much later after my grandfather passed away. But he and his uncles in Indian Gujarat, this small town, used to give haven, a safe haven, to Congress leaders when the British would come trying to arrest them because they were terrorists or conducting violent acts or whatever. I wish my grandfather had shared that with me when he was alive, because it would have made for a fascinating story for me to learn from. But increasingly, I look at that journey and I say, the first war of independence in India against British colonization happened in 1857. This was not just Muslims. Hindus and Muslims together rose up in rebellion. They were defeated. It took them another 90 years for leaders like Gandhi, Nehru, Ambedkar, Patel, Jinnah to achieve independence and an end to colonization of their lands. And yes, they disagreed on a lot of things, and this is why partition happened. But the Bengali in Indian Bengal and the Bengali in Bangladesh and the Gujarati in India and the Gujarati migrant in Pakistan and the Punjabis, we all have that shared history of rising up against colonization and walking for over a century to secure that freedom. And South Africans have that experience. Arabs have that experience. Many other cultures have that experience. And that's something to learn and draw inspiration from, and also be realistic that this takes a century, if not more, of organization and advocacy.
Absolutely. And I think this is, you made such an important point that I fear sometimes gets lost because of the horrors that we're seeing, you know, coming out of Gaza, that where, you know, some people are finding it really hard to maintain that sort of mindset of, you know, coexistence or peace or you know, whatever. And I don't blame them. I mean, I think I was watching a Palestinian journalist speaking about this concept of coexistence, and she said, listen, don't ask me about coexistence right now, because I first need to ensure that my people are going to continue to exist in the first place, let alone coexist with someone else, you know? And so I understand that Palestinians and also, by the way, Israelis in their own sort of mindset are also feeling like they are in an existential crisis. The October 7th attacks were the worst attacks on Jews since the Holocaust. And so there is a trauma there as well when we're talking about traumas. And I don't like comparing traumas. Oh, but this trauma is much bigger than that trauma. Trauma is trauma to whoever is facing it.
And the person facing it doesn't care for what the relative level of trauma for the other is.
100%. Now, that makes it all the more important for people who are outside of that sort of what I call it the epicenter of the trauma. The people at the epicenter of the trauma are not going to be the ones building bridges and calling for coexistence. They're worried about their own existence. But the people around them, and the farther away you get from that epicenter, right? So if you're someone living in DC, you're not even Jewish or Palestinian or Muslim or whatever, but you're just like creating problems and you're promoting radical, you know, ideas. You're making a problem worse when you have a responsibility to be making it better. You're not in the trauma sphere. So you have a moral responsibility to be the person who is talking about coexistence and peace and all of that stuff, because the people over there who are hurting aren't able to do that right now. So we have to help them. We have to do it for them. And the way we do that is something that you said, which I think is very important. It's recognizing that we can never truly be free unless everybody is free, unless everybody is treated fairly. A society that allows anti-Semitism is also going to allow Islamophobia and racism and anti-Black racism. So don't think that just because you're safe, if someone else is not safe, you're not really that safe either. And so we have to understand that in order to build these just societies in order to make sure the people we care about, the people we identify with, the causes we identify with are safe. We have to make sure everyone else around us is safe as well. We have to build an infrastructure of safety. And in order to do that, we have to do exactly what you said, which is build coalitions that are not just made up of people like us.
Last question, Jasmine. Something I've been thinking about, and I would love your thoughts on this. Over the last 6 months, at a personal level, in Washington, D.C., I've told this to friends in private. At times, I have felt that the culture of censorship in Washington is far stronger than the culture of censorship in Islamabad and Delhi, two capitals I'm very familiar with and go to quite often, and share my views with elites and people I trust and don't get along with at times very openly. I have listeners of the podcast will know very strong views on blasphemy laws, very strong views on secularism, very strong views on labeling certain sects of people as non-Muslims constitutionally. These are all things in Pakistan that are very sensitive topics. And people have been shot at, and people have been killed, and people have been jailed for voicing those views. But in the last 6 months, I found myself able to have these difficult conversations in Islamabad and New Delhi about what's going on in those countries far more openly, with far more respect than I found in my adopted home city of Washington, D.C. There's a deep culture of censorship that pre-October 7th, if somebody were to tell me this, I would have, like you said, you know, the African-American journalist reminds me, is like, welcome to the club. I would have like resisted that. I was like, what are you talking about? Not true. But it's been a reminder. And the question I had for you was like, for given your experience and you have been in these positions and know a lot of the cast of characters over the years, what is your advice to young foreign policy professionals and how they should go about resisting, maybe is a too strong a word, but eroding this culture of censorship in Western capitals, because it comes at a huge risk, right? You would know this better than most guests I've had. You say the wrong thing and your professional career is on the line. We've seen people be fired, people being doxxed, etc. But in a town where relationship and reputation is everything and you have ambitions on your professional career, it's a huge risk. And that's how censorship in the Western system, at least in DC, works. It's less about violence against you. It's more about violence against your career prospects. What's your advice? How do we combat this culture?
It's a very difficult question because I think the answer is going to be different for everybody. But I would say one thing I think that I would tell anybody, which is think about what your end goal is, all right? And work backwards from there. Now, if your end goal is to be in an influential position in foreign policy, then you're going to have to abide by certain rules, unfortunately. Again, things are changing slowly, but you're going to have to abide by certain rules in order to get to where you want to be. If that is where you want to be, and if you think that that is worthwhile, then you will have to find other ways of expressing your opinion in safer spaces that will not impact your career prospects. So whether it's with friends, whether it's in a club, you know, where people have the same views, you will find a way to say what you want to say and to get that out and to express your views and be around like-minded people without having to stand in front of the White House with a megaphone and like blaring your views and being blacklisted, you know, forever. That said, I know that there are a lot, again, things are changing very quickly. And now you have much more diversity in DC in terms of viewpoints and think tanks and institutions that have different viewpoints than it was when I was living there. It was quite a bit more uniform back then, but now you have progressive think tanks, you have more conservative think tanks, you know, you can try to find a home that fits your you know, sort of what you want to do and what you want to say. But again, I'll just come back to Not everybody has to be an activist. Not everybody has to say everything they think out loud. It depends on where do you think you belong in the spectrum, and what do you have to do to get there? And that answer is going to be different for everybody. So, I did 8 years at the Pentagon. I was a freelancer. I worked for think tanks. I worked for private sector. Now I don't work for anybody but myself. I can say whatever I want to say.
Quite liberating.
It's very liberating. I mean, there are pros and cons, of course, but the fact is, this is what I decided for me is the top priority, is that I need to be able to publicly express what I think is right and push back against what I think is not right. But that came after 20 years of building my credibility and not being able to speak out in order to get to this place where I finally have the freedom to say what I want. So, in your early career, you really have to think hard about what it is you eventually want to do. What do you want to become? What type of public figure do you want to become? What type of private figure? Do you imagine you will ever stand in front of Congress to be nominated for a congressionally approved position and have to respond to questions about, your past statements? If so, that's one path. Are you going to be a journalist who is on an independent station talking about injustices around the world? That is a different path. So young people need to be, as hard as it is sometimes, we all want to be able to be free and say whatever we want to say. Think about what it is you're trying to accomplish with your career and what you need to do to get there. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be much more helpful to society if you get to the point that you want to get to and contribute in the way that only you can. You're going to be much more helpful than doing something now that may cost you your career, but will end up not making a difference at all.
That is very good advice, and I strongly agree with every word you said about that. In fact, my own thought process over the last few months has been very similar to yours in the sense that I am 35 now, about to be 36 in 6 weeks. And now I'm at the point in my mid-career where I have some freedom and some clarity about my own trajectory and what I don't want to do, more importantly, versus what I want to do. And when you kind of know you don't want to be that person giving getting a political confirmation grilling,
Exactly.
you kind of know that okay, certain options now are open. And that again is important. And I will re underscore what you said is that we need all sorts of characters in the system. In the room. So yes, let some other people be more vocal, let other people be authors and experts, and let others be inside the system and trust each other and don't lose sight of the broader value you all share, which is justice, humanity, for all. I think we can conclude our conversation at this point, but my last question always to guests is, what are two or three books you would recommend to the audience?
Okay, I love this question. Actually, it was the hardest one that you sent me that I had to think about because I really had to go back and think about what imp I read so much and I have the worst memory. So I don't keep lists of what I read. So I have to, I always remember just like the last book that I read. But I thought about it a lot, and I would say, for personal reasons, I love Edward Said's book Out of Place because he, obviously Edward Said was a great figure, a great scholar. He talked a lot about Orientalism. He talked about different things with regards to Palestinians and the West and all of that stuff. But what I loved about his book, it was an autobiography, so it wasn't a policy book. And it was called Out of Place because he always felt that he never really fit in anywhere. I mean, he spent time in Egypt when he was young, Obviously, he's Palestinian. Then he went to the US and, always kind of feeling slightly out of place in everywhere that he went. And for me, I was born in New York. I spent my childhood in Egypt, and then I went back to the US, and then I've been living outside of both Egypt and the US, and I always feel slightly out of place no matter where I am, because I have all of these different places inside of me, and so I feel like I belong somewhere in between all of them. But I highly recommend the book for anyone who feels that way, for anyone who sort of feels like they identify with different cultures and different places. It's a great, great book. The other one is a bit more policy. It's very bit more policy oriented, but also personal. And it's a book called No Ordinary Time. And it's by this historian. She writes a lot of biographies about US presidents. She's written a bunch of US presidential biographies. And this story in particular is about FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, and his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, and how it's both personal and policy, in the sense that on one hand, it's the story of World War II and how the US went from having an army that still had horses in it, no joke, to just in a few years being the type of country that could help bring the world to defeat Nazism and come out of World War II and rebuild Europe and stuff. It's fascinating to see how FDR was able to make that happen. But the other part I love about it is that it talks about the relationship between FDR and Eleanor, and how she, at a time when women weren't really allowed to have influential positions, she was his most trusted advisor and actually used her trust with him to advocate for women in the workforce, for women in political positions, and to really be a role model to women wanting to go into policy positions and public positions. So it's a beautifully written book. It's a fascinating story, very well written, and there's a lot of very interesting anecdotes in it, including a very funny one about how when Winston Churchill would go to the White House to visit FDR so that they could plan out the campaigns for World War II. Apparently, he was a very bad influence on FDR, and they would stay up all night smoking cigars and talking. And so Eleanor really didn't like Churchill and tried to separate the two of them when he came over to visit. But anyway, just little stuff like that. It's a very entertaining book, but it's also very informative. So those are the two that I will leave you with.
Thank you for those recommendations, and I would say I am honored to be in the same category as Eleanor Roosevelt in my dislike and disdain for Winston Churchill. But my views on that are for different reasons. But we can talk about that at another time. But Jasmine, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your analysis and insights, and your advice to me, to our audience. Appreciate all that you've done. And all the work that you are doing, speaking up, sharing analysis on what is a very during what is a very difficult time. So Ramadan Mubarak again. Eid is
Ramadan
coming up,
Mubarak.
so Eid Mubarak in advance. And again, would love to have you on the podcast in the near future as well. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I really appreciated the chance to talk about these issues with you and your audience as well. So, Eid Mubarak and Ramadan Mubarak to them and to you as well. And thank you again so much.